Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In a quick check of valley traffic on the 10 eastbound, a crash blocks the intersection at State Route 143. Elsewhere, an accident on the 10 westbound at Central and on I-17 southbound at Greenway. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 75 today. Clear skies tonight with overnight lows in the lower 50s. Sunny and breezy tomorrow with a high of 80. Partly sunny on Sunday with a high of 81. It's sunny right now, 73 degrees. Tucson's largest private employer, Raytheon Missile Systems, today announced plans to add nearly 2,000 jobs in 5 years. From Tucson, Zach Ziegler reports.
Taylor Lawrence is president of the company's missile operations. He says the additional positions will encompass several career paths.
We're primarily focused on technical jobs, but we'll also hire folks in finance and contracts and supply chain and all that kind of stuff as well. So it's a little bit of everything, but we're kind of growing across the board.
Lawrence says such a large expansion will mean recruiting efforts will go well beyond University of Arizona graduates.
Our biggest pipeline comes from the U of A, and we expect that to continue. But we're also making sure we pull in students from all around the country, and we're showing off Southern Arizona and the lifestyle here. And I think we're getting some good folks.
He says alterations to roads around the facility made by Pima County are allowing for the expansion. The county last year moved one road south by half a mile to create a buffer and room for growth. Raytheon already employs more than 10,000 people at its missile plant near Tucson International Airport and at the U of A Tech Park on Rita Road. I'm Zach Ziegler reporting from Tucson.
Both the Republican and Democratic National Committees are looking for new chairmen. Reince Priebus will leave the RNC to become President-elect Donald Trump's new chief of staff, and the DNC has had an interim chair since Debbie Wasserman Schultz resigned over the summer. And Arizonans have been mentioned in conversations for both of those jobs, specifically Arizona GOP Chair Robert Graham for the RNC post and Congressman Ruben Gallego for the DNC. Here's Graham talking about that on election night.
Yeah, it's always a consideration. A lot of people have been very encouraging about it. This is one of these things where you don't aspire to be. It's a hard job, and you take a lot of bullets for doing the job. So I would just say if Donald Trump is the president, I'll support whoever he wants as the national chairman, because that's likely the process if we get a Republican president.
Joining me with more on this is Bruce Ash. He's Republican National Committeeman for Arizona. And Bruce, what would it mean for this state to have either the DNC or RNC chairs from here? Does it matter to Arizona at all?
It probably has some consequence, but the job of a national political party chair is to be the national political party chair, not the chairman from Arizona who's handling things on behalf of Arizona and Arizonans to the exclusion of anybody else. Both Mr. Graham as well as Mr. Gallego would probably be in the consideration for the chairmanship in both their parties, and rightfully so.
When political parties are looking at picking their chairs, do they look at where they're from as a way to say, for the Republicans, for example, Robert Graham might be a good person to have in here to make sure that, you know, Arizona stays Republican? And Democrats might say, well, if Congressman Gallego is in, you know, maybe that, you know, helps us turn Arizona blue. Is that ever a consideration?
Not necessarily. When you look at the last several RNC chairmen, two things pop out. One is that none of them are from major states. And number two, when the president of the United States is from your party, it's generally the president who helps recommend and direct who the chairman of either political party is going to be. It certainly was that case for the last, you know, roughly 7 3/4 years under the Obama administration. It was the same way under the George W. Bush administration. And I would expect that the Donald Trump team probably will have a lot to say as to who our next national party chair will be as well. And Robert Graham certainly has been the most effective fundraiser in Arizona Republican politics, maybe going back over a quarter century. That probably is as big a factor as anything else. The ability to raise money, the ability to get on the phone, go visit with people personally, raise money from donors, and understanding the digital and data portion of the running of a national political party, which again, Robert Graham has significant skills that he's developed both in his political activism as well as in his own personal business interests.
Do you think that having Donald Trump in the White House helps Robert Graham's potential candidacy? Do you think it has any kind of impact?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that you have to look at the campaign for the last several months. Jeff DeWitt, our Arizona State Treasurer, has been a very, very influential member of the inside Trump team back in New York City for the last several months. And Donald Trump is a guy who, being a businessman, looks at performance as well. And you know, Arizona was considered to be a battleground state. The Democrats wasted a heck of a lot of money in Arizona that they really didn't need to. Mr. Trump won here by approximately 5 percentage points, give or take. So Robert does have a very good opportunity. He's been close with Mr. Trump. He's close to Jeff DeWitt, and Jeff DeWitt is close with Mr. Trump.
Well, Bruce, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Bruce Ash is Republican National Committeeman from Arizona.
The director of the U.S. Census Bureau was in the Valley this week, meeting with the Maricopa Association of Governments and tribal leaders in the Valley. The 2020 census is estimated to cost more than $12 billion, which is less than it would cost if the Bureau repeated the process from 2010. Census Bureau Director John Thompson joins me. And Director Thompson, where are you now as far as planning for the 2020 census?
Right now, we're in the final stages of our planning to determine the questions that we'll ask on the census and exactly how we'll take the census, and we're planning an extensive end-to-end test that will center on April 1st, 2018 as the census reference day. And then after that, we will proceed to the census in 2020.
When you talk about how people will be taking the census, is that the discussion between paper versus some kind of electronic or other technology-driven questionnaire?
Exactly. So for the 2020 census, we're offering options for people to self-respond. So one of the primary options will be the internet, and this will be the first time that the internet has been used as a primary response option in a U.S. census. We're also going to be offering for the first time the telephone as an option for people to respond. They just have to call up and we'll take their interview over the phone. And we also understand that there are areas of the United States where people would prefer to respond by mail, and so we're planning to do that as well. So probably about 20% of the households in the United States will be offered a chance to respond right off the bat using a paper questionnaire.
When you talk about using the internet, security obviously comes into effect here. What kind of measures do you need to take, and how confident are you that you can take them so that the results are accurate and the results are secure?
Well, we take cybersecurity very, very seriously at the Census Bureau. So the underlying philosophy we have is all of our data is encrypted at rest and in transition. We also work very hard with a number of organizations to help make sure that we're on the cutting edge of cybersecurity.
You mentioned that you're also looking at potential questions for the 2020 census. Are you expecting that the questions will be different from 2010?
Right now, we are doing a final discussion with federal agencies and with OMB to make sure that we have all the current questions for the decennial census. To date, it seems like the questions are going to be pretty much the same, in fact, exactly the same as they were in 2010. There's a key date coming up, and it's the end of March of 2017, and by then we will submit the topics for the census to the Congress.
Do you change topics from decade to decade?
If you look at the history of the census, the topics have changed over the course of the census, but it's been really reflective of the needs of the country to support, you know, fair redistricting and fair allocation of funds.
How do you go about really trying to count everybody, especially when you consider there are 11 some odd million undocumented folks living in the U.S.? How do you go about making sure you get everybody?
So what we really started doing, and this was with the 2000 census, was we began aggressively doing two things. We started paying for advertising as opposed to relying on public service announcements. And we also started putting our money into partnership specialists. And these are individuals that could work with local communities, local leaders, to really get the word out on a grassroots level about how important the census was, one, and two, how confidential the answers that people respond to the census are kept.
Do you have a target in mind for what percentage of respondents do so by themselves on the internet?
Our target for the internet would be about 55% of the population responded on the internet, and then the rest would respond either by paper or by telephone.
John Thompson is the director of the U.S. Census Bureau. Director Thompson, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on 91.5. Thanks for being here. With the takeaways, John Hockenberry. Now, let's talk about one of the more noticeable impacts of the decennial census, the drawing of congressional districts and how many districts each state gets. That redistricting map determines everything from picking local representatives to determining the racial diversity of the delegation that goes to Washington.
The politicization of this process, known as gerrymandering, helped Republicans. Democrats won 47% of House seats in 2012, despite winning 51% of all major party votes cast. That's an issue that President Obama and former Attorney General Eric Holder have pledged to focus on after President-elect Trump takes office in January. Rebecca Tippett is director of Carolina Demography at the Carolina Population Center at UNC Chapel Hill. She breaks down how the redistricting process actually works and the changing maps that affect America's political future.
The first step of this process really occurs for most states every decade, and it follows the decennial census. So the next census is April 1st, 2020. And, you know, the most important thing there is getting an accurate and complete count. And that's very important for both state and local politics. And then after that, those seats in the House are apportioned to the states. And then those states, whether they have more seats or fewer seats or the same number of seats, they will be then engaging in what's called the redistricting process, where they will take the decennial census count and they will say, okay, how much population needs to be shifted to make the districts currently equal in population size? Because it's a very strict standard for equality of population.
What is supposed to be the process of constructing a congressional district map as perhaps the framers understood it and as it has traditionally been understood?
The way that it's currently done has really been evolving over a series of Supreme Court decisions. When we think about redistricting, one of the most common phrases that you'll hear today is the phrase one person, one vote. And that is based on strict equality of total population. But when you go back, part of that one person, one vote really emerged because in the early 20th century, you had very extreme cases of what's called malapportionment, where you had extreme inequity in district size across states. Even when we go back in relatively near history, say 70 to 100 years ago, you see that redistricting had very few guidelines around it. And we are only now seeing that landscape emerge as we end up seeing challenges over equality and voting and what is a fair vote. And I think those debates are still ongoing.
What has been the priority of redistricting in the era that has been characterized as gerrymandering? I don't know if that's these days or if that's been going on for quite a long time. It's an old term.
It has definitely been going on for a very long time. And the first priority for all district line drawers is going to be to make sure that you draw legal districts. And that means, first and foremost, equality of population. And second, there are some protections for minority voting rights that may necessitate the drawing of a majority-minority district. After that, there are no explicit federal guidelines that govern the redistricting process for seats in the House of Representatives. States are welcome to develop their own guidelines, and many have, but technically partisan gerrymandering is legal.
How does district map drawing and redistricting affect the likelihood that one party or another will win the House of Representatives?
So how that gets done is through a process that political scientists may refer to as either cracking or packing, and I think stacking is another term that sometimes gets used. And that's the idea that if you know where the opposition voters are, you can either spread them thinly across a variety of districts and dilute the voting power, or, you know, pack them into guaranteed safe districts.
Have you seen a district in your experience that looks so bizarre that it really tests your belief in the process?
Definitely. I think it's very easy, I think, to point to districts and say, well, that looks so bizarre. But to me, the more I researched into it, the more complicated I found. And I would not say that you can necessarily tell a bad district by looking at it, because there are multiple interests that you can have. And at the end of the day, they can be competitive with each other. So you may make trade-offs on preserving communities of interest. And how you define communities of interest is not defined anywhere. So I do think that there needs to be some consensus, at least at the state level, on what makes a good district so that individuals can know when they are looking at a district how to evaluate it.
In demography terms, what's been happening in the United States in terms of population shifts, birth rates, and changes in ethnic diversity?
So one of, at the biggest picture scale that we have, the national scale, we have really seen that the southern and western states are growing much faster than many of the Midwestern and Northeastern states. Political power and representation in the House of Representatives and, you know, the number of electors in the Electoral College will continue to increase in many of the southern and western states. Texas, in particular, is predicted to pick up anywhere from 2 to 3 seats in the House of Representatives, potentially, after 2020. North Carolina is going to gain 1. I believe Florida is predicted to gain 1 or 2. At the same time, states like Ohio, Pennsylvania are predicted to lose a seat in the House of Representatives.
Rebecca Tippett is Director of Carolina Demography at the Carolina Population Center at UNC Chapel Hill. She spoke to us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
They call themselves the conscience of the art world. The Gorilla Girls have been using humor and facts to challenge museum directors and gallery owners around the world about the lack of diversity in their art collections for 30 years. And tonight they'll be bringing that message to Tempe. The show's Lauren Gilger recently spoke with one of the founding members of the Gorilla Girls about that message. But Lauren, you can't actually tell us her name, is that right?
Well, I don't actually know her name. I only know her pseudonym, which is Kata Kollwitz. Since the Gorilla Girls were founded in 1985, they've been anonymous every time they appear. They wear gorilla masks and all black, and they only identify themselves by pseudonyms of dead women artists. So Kata Kollwitz was a German artist who was active in politics in the early 1900s. And she told me the group's members originally chose to be anonymous because they didn't want this protest art to affect their separate careers as artists under their real names.
But we almost immediately realized that the delicious secret of who we might be was a fantastic thing for the Gorilla Girls. So it's one of the secrets of our success.
So how do they protest the art world exactly?
They'll do things like put up a billboard outside of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York that says, "Do women have to be naked to get into the Met?" Because they'll point out less than 5% of the artists in the modern art sections there are women, but 85% of the nudes in the museum are female. And they've been doing this kind of thing for decades now. So when I talked to Kollwitz, I asked her if it's gotten any better in the art world in all that time.
Just in terms of museums today, they know they should be doing better. Many people inside museums want to do better, but it's very hard to turn those big ships around. Museums are stuck with their collections. And since the only valuable artists pretty much, you know, before about 40 years ago or so, were male artists, museums have these collections of mostly white male art.
So I want to talk about some of the approaches that you use, which is mainly humor, to sort of address these very serious issues. Why is that the direction you went, using humor?
we were formed with the idea of this new kind of poster that twisted an issue around and presented it a little differently. And humor, facts, outrageous visuals, humor especially, helps us get kind of under the radar and into people's brains. We feel like we have a direct link, because if you can get someone to laugh at an issue who doesn't agree with you, you might get them to see something differently and change their minds.
So how do you think focusing on facts, on the numbers like that, rather than the quality of the work, has affected the success of this cause?
Well, quality is very subjective. Quality was a word used to keep out women and artists of color from fancy art galleries and museums. But what is quality, really? I mean, there's so many fantastic artists out there. Quality is in the eye of the beholder. And in terms of art in the United States, the art in museums is mostly art bought by very wealthy collectors over centuries. In fact, originally it was kings and queens. So it's their taste that you see in the museums. There's no one idea of quality. There's such a huge diversity of art that different people care about.
So focusing on the facts is a more direct way to deliver your message?
You know, our work has been hanging in Tate Modern and many other museums a lot lately, and sometimes for years at a time. And we get these emails from people because they went into the museum thinking art was a meritocracy and whatever was in there was the best stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they go out thinking, wow, I should pay attention to what the makeup of the museum is. Where are the artists from? Are they all European artists? Are there artists of color? Are there women artists? Are there trans artists? All of these things are really worth thinking about. It doesn't make you dislike art or still care about the art you care about, but it expands your idea of what art should be. I mean, if a museum doesn't include the entire story of our culture, it's not preserving history. It's just preserving the taste of the rich and powerful.
So I wonder, I just went to the Met. I was in New York recently, and I went to the Met with some friends. And, you know, everybody immediately goes to see, you know, the Picassos or the Monets. Does that bother you? Is that something you think should change?
I think you can love any art you love. And of course, many people love Picasso or even more Van Gogh. But the important thing is, where is the actual art of that time? And if it's just reduced to 4 or 5 people, that's not the art. I mean, museums can't collect everything, but actually, artists have always been influenced by each other, and they're part of their own time and subject to the forces of it. So museums need to cast a wider net and show us the range of what was going on.
Kanta Kollwitz is giving a free lecture on ASU's Tempe campus tonight, and tomorrow she's hosting an art and activism workshop at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
The real-life emotion around Arizona's SB 1070 and tension at the U.S.-Mexico border have been tackled in recent fiction, but not in quite the way the new play Nogales does it. Blending humor and drama, the production offers a complex version of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio and others who help give perspectives on the shooting of a Mexican boy by the U.S. Border Patrol. Performances are happening this weekend at the Mesa Arts Center, and its writer Richard Montoya joins me. Richard, you took an almost journalistic approach to this. You and your collaborators interviewed some people and used that for the basis of the play. How did that end up working?
It's a journalistic, you use the word, and it's absolutely right, ethnographic. I mean, you go out and you gather stories, and you talk to people, and you want to engage people. So, for example, with Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who, you know, politically, we might be way left of Joe, but when we gained access into his office, when he gave us the audience, or allowed us to be audience, I told my crew of four, suits and ties, and we're going to walk in there like professionals. We're going to uphold the journalistic ethics that you're supposed to be fair, and a no-spin zone, to borrow a phrase from a true hero of ours, Bill O'Reilly. But we'd go in there and actually give the sheriff the respect that we would any law man or law woman. And that was very helpful because we were told going in that we'd have 15 minutes with the sheriff because he's a very busy man. And 2 hours fly by. And suddenly Sheriff Joe is asking me to come over to his desk. And he was going to play some Frank Sinatra for me. He did it his way. And, you know, really letting his guard down and giving us the gold coins of the sheriff's office and the pink underwear. And before you know it, you're able to get just a little bit closer to Joe to understand his thinking and to kind of unravel the idea for us was, could he answer some questions as the son of Italian immigrants? Would he talk to us about the idea of Christian charity, these kinds of things? And we lobbed a few softballs in there, but he began to, in a sense, trust us, and we didn't. It wasn't a trick, and I got you a trick, you know, and to trick him into something or to betray him. He's portrayed in this show as a three-dimensional, complex human being.
With all the stuff you've done, do you feel like theater itself, and maybe art more generally, has to be? I don't want to say controversial because that can be a buzzword, but at least thought-provoking. Does it have to be? Does it have to challenge people's sensibilities?
I think so. There's always the sort of fare that people can go see, you know, a light musical or one of the classics, perhaps. But if you look at the works of Shakespeare and even the Greeks, Aristophanes, there's always something brewing. There's many things brewing, usually a cauldron of things brewing, and there's... It's almost like the way The Simpsons used to work. And again, going back to some of the animation films I take my son now to, there's many, many levels going on. There's something for the kids. There's something for the parents. There's something in the middle. And I think that, you know, bang for your dollar, if one could call Nogales a political piece of theater, but I think one would be very surprised of how much humor there is. And there's something in the end, Steve, that I feel the responsibility of not putting a Pollyanna rose-colored end on it, but there has to be some hope in the end, some sort of town hall where we met in the middle and we had a little bit better understanding leaving the theater than we came in. And this doesn't mean to portend or pretend or to be pretentious or we're not that precious about our stuff. It's pretty knockabout, rock'em sock'em physical theater. There's out of nowhere, Joe Arpaio singing a song. Where did that come from? It can't be all, you know, guns, bullets, and the devil.
As a Latino man, and even though a very creative one, do you feel at any point where, is this an outlet that you need, not just because you're good at it and because it's your career, but even as a human being, because there are certain things that you don't like how certain people might look at you because of your background or whatnot. Do you feel like the theater can also be an outlet for that?
Well, listen, it's been a lot cheaper than therapy, and it's been a whole lot more fun. And it is a very tense period of time right now. I won't say that it's not. But in this tense period of time, if we can provoke laughter, provoke thought, it's going to help our cause, and we're going to... not advance humanity, so to say, but we've always kind of operated with that mandate of how can we better things, not so much add to the larger bonfire, more fuel to the fire, but how can we kind of untangle and unravel some things so that we might have an understanding or at least share a laugh or go to the bar and have a cocktail or, you know, keep the discussion going.
Richard Montoya of the theater group Culture Clash. His show Nogales, Storytellers in Cartel Country, is being performed this weekend at the Mesa Arts Center.
The Valley this weekend will be home to an event with a beat. KJZZ's Naomi Gingold is with me to talk about this. And Naomi, what's going on?
Well, it's the Arizona Hip Hop Festival. It's an all-day event run by a group called Respect the Underground. And it brings together all these new and established artists. But at its core, the festival is old school hip hop. Because when you used to talk about hip hop, people would say hip hop isn't just about rapping. Hip hop is about the four elements: DJing, breakdancing, rapping, and graffiti. And this festival has got it all. It also has an open mic for anyone who might want to go out and display their rap or beatboxing skills. Mark, think you're up for it?
Yeah, I don't think there's anybody who wants to hear that.
Well, you can also just go see some good shows. So I spoke to Justice Samuel, who is the CEO of Respect the Underground, and asked him how the festival started.
The Hip Hop Festival was birthed out of necessity. We had no annual events focused primarily on the independent Arizona hip hop community. We have a thriving independent community.
The Hip Hop Festival itself started 3 years ago?
Yes, ma'am. We did the inaugural festival in 2014, but we did it because that was always the goal of Respect the Underground, was to host an annual event that people could look forward to and work towards every year that could bring all walks of life together, regardless of the neighborhood or type of hip hop or ethnicity or financial background. Doesn't matter if you're the most successful artist in the valley or you're just a young kid on an open mic and you want to come out and test your chops. Everybody from all over Arizona coming, having their merch table set up with their CDs and their stickers and their hats, but at the same time celebrating each other, so networking amongst each other and supporting each other. So when rapper from Mesa is on stage, the guy from West Phoenix is standing in the crowd showing his support and engaging him and vice versa, which would therefore create camaraderie amongst the artists, creating a sense of community. We've always had an Arizona hip-hop community, don't get it twisted. It's just always been so segregated, cliquey, and geographically niche. So now we're here, and we have an overabundance of artists that just needed a platform and a microphone to let their voice be heard, and Respect the Underground provides that.
So what can we look forward to at the festival this weekend? What are we going to see?
We're starting off the day with a label panel. So this year we have brought out Big Hef from Island Def Jam, Rel Carter from Roc Nation of Jay-Z fame, and No Limit Forever. Then doors open at 10 a.m. Performances will begin at approximately 11:30. We have 8 stages running simultaneously, with one open mic stage that is focused on anyone and everyone who wants to come out. We allocated 2,000 tickets to the Phoenix Union School District so the kids could come out and sign up for the open mic and rock out, maybe win a microphone or something to help them better their craft. We have over 50 live painters, but then we do, on the other side of the fence, have a graffiti competition. So you'll have that. Then from the dance aspect, we have Miguel Gravity and Rising Dynasty coming out, and they have a B-boy and B-girl expedition, and it's all little boys and girls are going to come out and just tear it up. Then we have 3 nationally recognized DJs, and they're going to be doing what's called Scratch Exchange. Anyone who attends a festival, they get to come out and learn how to scratch. Then you have what is called Beat Street. Beat Street is a producer panel with over 50 producers, located all Arizona-based producers that will be showcasing their beats, networking, sharing software and hardware, as well as selling beats.
This is like old school hip hop culture to the max, is what it sounds
like.
Yes,
ma'am. This is founded in the roots of hip hop culture. It's founded in the 4 elements, the 4 key elements.
So I heard that the mayor's going to be coming out that day?
Yes, ma'am. Mayor Greg Stanton and City Hall and the Phoenix government have stood behind it, and they have proclamated it as the inaugural Hip Hop Day. And we'll be recognizing it every third Saturday of November from here on out in conjunction with the Arizona Hip Hop Festival.
So this is mainly Arizona hip hop artists, right?
No, ma'am. It's 100% Arizona hip hop artists.
So tell me, can you give me like a couple artists that you're like, you should really know about these people?
One of the artists that you really got to be up on is Odd Squad Family, the most unique rap group you've ever seen in your life. Nubs, he was born with no arms and no legs. He performs on stage on 2 prosthetics. He attaches the mic to his nub with a sweatband. And his partner is an albino African American who is legally blind. He's supposed to rise and I'm the hottest in the fire. You gotta aim higher. So when you make it further than they thought, nah, nobody can deny you. Look, the brighter the limelight, the bigger the crowd. I've dedicated my life. They are one of the dopest groups in the world for hip hop. And it's not because of their challenges, it's because they make dope music. Then there's Dee the Ruler, who is signed to Kid Ink's label Alumni. He's toured the world. I call him the Kendrick Lamar of Arizona.
Justice, thank you so much for talking to me and telling me about this. Good luck with the festival.
I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
The scandal involving Wells Fargo opening accounts without their customers' permission has cost the bank $185 million in fines. And new reporting from the Wall Street Journal finds some of the practices that got Wells Fargo in hot water started in Arizona. Emily Glazer is banking reporter at the paper, and she joins me. So, Emily, it seems like Arizona had a pretty big role in the scandal.
As we've been reporting about this for the last year or so, what we've realized is that there were certain hotspots or pockets around the country that were really intensely impacted by this. It's no secret that Southern California had its fair share of woes with this, as the LA Times reported back in 2013. But as we've written, there were some areas, especially Arizona, along with the area around Miami, Florida, and Newark, New Jersey, that were really big hot pockets. And I came across an anonymous employee letter, a Wells Fargo employee, that was sent to top executives, and it cites this allegedly questionable practices and how it flourished in the Arizona region.
Did you find that there is something about the way banking is regulated here or something about Arizona that made this a good place for this kind of practice to happen? Or was it just the specific managers who were here at the time, they just happened to be here, who were really promoting this kind of thing?
I think it was more the latter. It's interesting you asked that, though. I haven't come across anything specific in terms of regulations. What we've heard is that it really was specific managers and then the way they were able to then train other employees these various skills that would enable these practices to grow, even though they really should never have happened at all.
You also wrote about how some bank workers would target college students, and I would imagine that, you know, this area was a great target for that kind of practice because ASU is one of the biggest public universities in the whole country.
This was something that hit a little scarily close to home. We had heard about bankers targeting college students in a little bit more of a vague fashion in our reporting, but we weren't really able to prove it very much because it was usually one-off anecdotes. And then through this letter and the supporting documents, we learned that one of the managers, Misha Terrazas, who's still overseeing a huge chunk of Arizona, earlier in her career at Wells Fargo, oversaw the area right near ASU. And they would have a ton of various marketing programs during the school's fraternity and sorority rush week to join the various Greek organizations. And they would basically bring Wells Fargo swag to encourage students to open accounts and give away anything from iPod shuffles to, you know, T-shirts. But college students had to open 4 banking products to receive the gifts, according to this letter. However, the manager, Misha Terrazas, would direct employees that gifts like the iPods could only be doled out if a student opened a minimum of 6 banking products. And if you just take a moment to think about that, I mean, you know, we got checking account, savings account, credit card, debit card. So that's 4. If you're a college student, you know, I don't know if you're taking out a mortgage, maybe an auto loan. Okay, so that, you know, it gets a little very questionable.
Given Wells Fargo's footprint in both in the Metro Phoenix area and in Arizona more broadly, do you get the sense that this overall scandal and maybe what you're reporting now about Arizona's role as sort of an epicenter of these kinds of practices, will that have any impact on the role that this particular bank plays here, do you think?
Oh, I definitely think so. There's been so much public reporting about Arizona and how it is one of the epicenters of Wells Fargo's problems. In fact, I came across an internal Wells Fargo document as of mid-2016 that the Arizona region had 438 customer complaints. Again, that's as of mid-2016 in 179 of its 250 branches. It's remarkable. So they're going to have to make a lot of changes to recognize how these problems have persisted and have grown across the state. You know, they really can't ignore it now.
Emily Glazer is banking reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Arizona voters approved Prop 206 earlier this month with more than 58% of the vote. The measure will increase the state's minimum wage, phasing it into $20 an hour by 2020. It also mandates paid sick time for workers. Supporters had argued the higher minimum wage would be good for workers and the economy, while critics worried it would be bad for business and, by extension, their employees. To try to get a sense of what the impact of Arizona's higher minimum wage might be, I'm joined by Dennis Hoffman. He's an economics professor at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. And Dennis, let's look to the past first. What kinds of impacts have we seen on Arizona businesses in the years since voters approved the last minimum wage increase?
Well, it's very difficult to tease out, you know, specific impacts in Arizona. You know, the minimum wage levels are still quite low today in Arizona. So they wouldn't be the binding types of levels that we're going to see now over the next several years. So identifying particular impacts in Arizona today has been difficult. Experiments where this has been run, say in Washington State, in Seattle, I think that the evidence is mixed, but I think that there is some evidence of a decline in the demand for workers in the area, or pressing your staff out to be more productive somehow. Discernible impacts to date in Arizona, though, I don't know of any.
With the passage of Prop 206, do you expect to see more discernible impacts one way or the other on Arizona businesses?
Well, I think that indeed, when you face a significant increase in an input price for your business, you've got to have a reaction somewhere. So it's only logical to expect that we'll see somewhat fewer hours worked. And sometimes you see this, Mark, in a slower growth trajectory in employment in the sector. In other words, sometimes it's difficult to tease these results out, but if you could forecast 2 to 3 to 4% growth employment in the sector going forward, now you impose the law, maybe you see only 1% or 2% growth in the sector instead of the 3 or 4. So we'll have to monitor this really quite closely. I think the way to do it correctly is to monitor individual businesses, look at their staff today, monitor it over the next 4 years, talk with employers about their action and reaction.
Does it have less of an impact on businesses that the entire state has this minimum wage as opposed to a city here, a city here, and everybody sort of does their own thing?
Absolutely, Mark. This is an important point. We're all in this together kind of thing. I think that many of the severe and adverse impacts to minimum wage in terms of employment or price or especially employment loss have come when you have two like-sized businesses or similar businesses in close proximity to one another. One is exposed to the minimum wage legislation and the other is not. Well, that's clearly not the case in Arizona if you have a statewide law.
In general, do workers who earn the minimum wage, what's their mobility? I mean, do they look at a place like Arizona and say, okay, here's the minimum wage here. In California, the minimum wage is this. In New Mexico, it's this. And where they go based on that? Or do they sort of stick where they're at?
The history of Arizona has demonstrated that we certainly have been fueled by net domestic in-migration over the decades. And that has slowed dramatically over the last 8 years. I'm not suggesting that the minimum wage hike will turn water into wine, as it were here, or will dramatically change that trajectory. But it merits careful look, I think, as we go forward. You know, will better treatment of employees send a signal to people that are contemplating moving here that Arizona is not only a great place to live, but it's a place where workers are treated well?
Dennis Hoffman is a professor of economics at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Dennis, thanks as always.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day.
Phoenix Afrobeat Orchestra is a local band featuring 16 musicians who all play different genres of music. Tomorrow night, they'll release their debut album called Pow, and KJZZ's Sarah Ventry spoke with two members of the group about this.
Yeah, I talked with the group's founder and bassist, David Marquez, and the lead vocalist, Camille Sledge. And they're really influenced by a Nigerian musician named Fela Kuti, who was really well known for his political activism, and he's also credited with creating the style of music that's known as Afrobeat. So I started by asking both of them about what Afrobeat music is and the relationship it has with social justice.
It's a little bit funk, it's soul, it's R&B, it's jazz, it is African songs from the tribes and from the communities, all put together, and it became something else.
My sister actually introduced me to it. She was like, check this out. She was living in New York City at the time, and she would just go to parties, and, you know, they'd play stuff that was really funky, and she's like, yeah, check out this guy named Fela Kuti. It was like, how can you combine all of these and it sound like this?
And also, like, you know, when I discovered Fela and his story, the struggle that he had against corruption in Lagos, Nigeria, against being his own person and doing the things that a free person would do. And, you know, he was like arrested over 500 times. He's just very, very inspirational. And to follow that path, which is to bring people together in a positive light and to maybe speak against something that is plaguing our humanity.
You know, that's the thing with Afrobeat. After you get done, you know, shaking the booty, you're just like, hold on, what is he saying? You go back and listen to these words and you listen to these strong lyrics and you're like, this is dead serious, you know? So that's when you start to feel like you need to understand what this artist is talking about. After days of working long, hours going on and on. Can't believe your money's low. You need your money just to grow. Never allow yourself contentment. Always remember that resentment. But your children, they will watch and do the same when they get drunk. And there's definitely still a lot of problems that we need to address. And so I think that music is the most powerful way you can do that, because you can reach so many people with one microphone, you know what I mean?
And you can bring people together even without words. Mm-hmm. And if you make them move together, then you've already united people that maybe don't have anything in common with each other and would speak against each other, mm-hmm. given the chance. So, like, if you put it in that context, then what we do is important. It can be powerful, and we don't take that very lightly at all.
Part of the energy of your live show comes from the fact that you have such a large band, that there are so many of you, and there's so much going on. You've 16 members? Is it challenging to have a band that's that big and to create like layers and textured sound without it sounding cluttered?
There are definitely rules to Afrobeat. And you know, when we write, we have boundaries, we have parameters. So there's guidelines to what has been set before us. And the music of Afrobeat itself is complex. There's hidden art in there, that it's many small pieces that come together and repeat, and those create this layer. And when you repeat that over and over again, and without, and it takes discipline. There's some of the really great players, like awesome guitar players, that could just wail, but they don't. And they don't because there's a reason for it. The reason is that they need to repeat, because what we do is trance music. It puts people in a trance.
When you have a polyrhythmic music like this, and everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing, even the vocalist, you know, it's almost like another instrument. You're one of us, one of us, one of us, one of us. It's the power, 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 power. Come with us, come with us. You don't sing so melodically like you would on another song. It's very much another instrument, another vehicle in the Afrobeat realm. So with all of us knowing that, and with all of us having studied and all of us having these rules, like David said, it becomes easier now because we're able to, you know, everybody stay in pocket and kind of know what you're supposed to do when we write a new song.
Thinking about that Afrobeat music and the kind of music you play is important on like a lot of different levels, and that there is maybe what people may see as kind of a duality of like a, you know, on the one hand it's this really funky music and it makes you want to move and dance and smile, and on the other hand there's this kind of responsibility that comes with it to take into account who started making this music and what those people's stories are and kind of what is our place in all of this, and what are our privileges, and what are the things that we need to be kind of fighting for and recognizing. Is it ever overwhelming to take all of that on?
To me, I don't think it is. I think it's like, it's life, you know? Sometimes life is overwhelming, but you don't stop because you just feel like you're overwhelmed, you know? You have to, especially if you have a responsibility like children, or like I do, I'm a mom, you know. If you have a responsibility like your community, music is a vehicle. But I think that life is something that it doesn't get tiring because it's also so enjoyable and it's so wonderful, you know. So you just do it. I do hip hop. The same rules apply when you're taking a form of music that came before you, and that music arose out of a sort of type of struggle. And lots of music genres came out of this, you know, come out of a struggle, and then it births this wonderful music. But this music carries a big heavy weight with it because it's important. And this music is also gonna reach a lot of people in different ways. It is a big weight, but you know you can carry it because you push yourself to be more and more strong every day.
That was Camille Sledge and David Marquez of Phoenix Afrobeat Orchestra talking about their debut album, POW. They'll be performing tomorrow night at the Crescent Ballroom in Phoenix.
And that's KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.